This is the crisis point.
Welcome to the Crisis Point podcast, where, like G.K. Chesterton, we discuss nothing except for politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I am your host, Michael Warren Davis, the editor of Crisis Magazine, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Philip F. Lawler, the director of the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at the Thomas More College of Liberal Arts in Merrimack, New Hampshire. And I thank you all for joining us. On the lineup for today, a priest in Sacramento was just excommunicated for denying that Pope Francis is really the successor of Peter. But before we go into that, even bigger story perhaps, former Vice President Joe Biden, has the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, has finally chosen his vice presidential candidate. He will be joined on the Democratic ticket, presumably, by former California Senator Kamala Harris. And Phil, what do we think of that choice?
Well, it's an interesting choice from a Catholic perspective because Kamala Harris is sort of poster girl for anti-Catholicism in the U.S. Senate during her stay there. Most blatantly, when she questioned whether someone was a suitable nominee for a federal court position because he was a member of the Knights of Columbus, which she would have us believe is some sort of subversive organization.
Yeah, that's right. She said, so if you don't mind, for so she asked, his name was Brian Boucher, and he was at a Senate hearing for his appointment as a district judge in Nebraska. And so Kamala Harris asked Judge Boucher, "Were you aware that the Knights of Columbus opposed a woman's right to choose when you joined the organization?" And then she asked, "Were you aware that the Knights of Columbus opposed marriage equality when you joined the organization?" Now, this gentleman joined the Knights of Columbus in 1993, which was, I don't think anyone was really in favor of quote-unquote marriage equality back in the day. The earliest poll I could find was conducted by Gallup in 1996, which showed that less than 30% of the country supported marriage equality, as it said. I doubt even Kamala Harris had that on her radar at that time. So it's clearly political posturing. But as you say, Phil, I mean, these are not, you know, she's clearly painting the Knights of Columbus out to be some sort of ideological radicals. But in fact, you know, the issues that she takes with the Knights are points of faith for mainstream Catholics. It's the bare minimum of Catholic moral theology. So what she's really saying is not that the Knights of Columbus are an extremist organization, but that the Catholic Church is an extremist organization.
That's right. That's the clear implication of what she's saying. And it's consistent with her voting record. It's consistent with her endorsement by and endorsement of Planned Parenthood. It's consistent with her having officiated at a same-sex marriage, which, by the way, so did Joe Biden.
Her too?
So we have a ticket that's clearly not just at odds with Catholic teaching, but inimical, hostile to Catholic teaching and to those who hold it.
So what about Biden? Because he's a quote-unquote devout Catholic, and I'm not interested in challenging the man's personal faith. I think he opens himself up to a certain amount of scrutiny when he and his surrogates are so relentlessly touting the fact that he is a quote-unquote devout Catholic, and that he wears a rosary on his wrist and things like that, which, by the way, I mean, I think most Catholics know that a rosary isn't jewelry. A rosary is something that you pray with, but it doesn't matter. So again, I don't want to, he opens himself up to the criticism. I'm not going to take that line of attack myself, but it may be valid. More interestingly is the fact that Mr. Biden is the poster child for this idea that, you know, you can be personally pro-life. You can be faithful to the church's teachings in your own private conscience. But as a statesman or even as a voter, you can vote for pro-choice candidates. This is a totally false distinction, obviously, that these people just make up out of thin air. It has absolutely no basis in church teaching or in or in human reason. But that, you know, that's just the way that it is, isn't it?
Well, he's gone beyond that too, hasn't he? As I say, he personally officiated at a same-sex marriage. Now, if you say you're personally not supportive of same-sex marriage, but you don't deny people the right to contract that marriage, that's one thing. I think it's an indefensible position, logically, philosophically. But politically, it seems to hold together because people want it to. But he didn't have to officiate at the wedding. That was a positive action that makes it pretty clear what he personally thinks. Whatever, however he protests his Catholic faith, he clearly does not make it match his personal actions.
Yeah, I don't. Again, I'm not going to impugn any judgment on him, but to officiate, objectively to officiate at a same-sex marriage, is quote-unquote marriage, is not only to facilitate a certain kind of carnal sin that we don't need to name, but it's also potentially the simulation of a sacrament, which is very, very dangerous, possibly even more dangerous than the sin of the flesh. So and the only way that he could know this is if he's never heard of any of any of the refutations of pro-life and pro-SSM democratic politicians that have been published, you know, or speeches that have been given, homilies. Since really, I mean, it started with John Kerry in 2000, didn't it? This is an old 2004. This is an old debate, and Catholic priests, even ones that tend to lean left, have been unequivocal on this. You know, there are certain issues where the church does believe that there is, despite something being objectively morally evil, the government isn't obligated to take legal action against it. There's a very small category of things like that. Same-sex marriage does not fall into that category. And God knows abortion absolutely does not fall into that category. If you believe truly, as the Catholic Church teaches, that life begins at conception, whether or not to kill an innocent human being is not a matter of personal conscience. That is a matter of human rights.
Of course. And it's not just the Catholic Church. It's science that teaches us that human life begins at conception.
Exactly.
So it's not an issue of it's not a confessional issue. It's an issue of fundamental human rights and human decency and justice that you don't take the life of an innocent human being.
And it's John Henry Newman toasting, you know, to conscience, the Pope, but conscience first, you know. And in the same way, you know, there are God blesses some people with the gift of faith. But he blesses almost everyone with the gift of reason. You know, even if as long as your rational soul makes a connection with the hardwire, the hardware in your brain, you're good to go. And so Joe Biden, even if he was raised Hindu, you know, he should be able to see that that life does begin at conception, and that, you know, his Catholic faith is not an excuse to overlook that. That scientific
no, it isn't.
Fact, by the just the opposite.
Exactly. I was going to say that when you say that he can get out of this argument only if he is unaware of all the arguments of the past, 20, 30, 40 years.
Right.
And to say that you're unaware of those arguments, although you're a public figure involved in these debates, is to say that you're incompetent. So his defense is incompetence, which is not a qualification for the highest office in the land.
That's true. I mean, he has personally been denied communion, hasn't he?
At least once, I know, yeah.
He has had this canonical penalty brought against him by ministers of the church. I don't know if he's ever witnessed a pro-life politician having communion withheld for upholding the right of the unborn to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But I doubt it. I mean, I don't think that there could possibly be any confusion in his own mind.
No, there's a problem with this ticket, and it's a problem of anti-Catholicism, and it's also a problem of honesty in presentation. Mm-hmm. And the choice of Kamala Harris is actually a way, I think, highlighting this. Do you recall that during the debates leading up to the presidential primaries, Kamala Harris said that she believed the women who were accusing Biden of being abusive.
That's right.
So she's taking a position supporting someone who she says she believes is an abuser.
As Democrats have done for decades since
the
Bill Clinton events. So, I mean, and this is, I don't want to give Ms. Harris any cover on this because she doesn't deserve any. But if the breaking news here is that politicians lie and debase themselves in order to gain power, then this might not be such a spectacular revelation. But I totally agree that Kamala Harris is that's true of politicians as a rule, but Kamala Harris is a particularly egregious instance of this, because not only the sexual abuse thing, but she basically accused Joe Biden publicly of being a supporter of segregation and Jim Crow during another one of the debates. And again, she had absolutely no problem taking the stage with him and accepting, the role of his running mate.
She is a funny character because, as you say, it's not news when a politician switches positions makes contradictory public statements for the benefit of the vote. But she really has elevated to an art form. I mean, just yesterday I saw a statement from her about how when she was in college, she said that she smoked marijuana while listening to Snoop Dogg. Now, Snoop Dogg was not recording at that time.
Oh, is that true?
So that statement is false. So now you're in the unique position of questioning whether a vice presidential candidate is telling the truth when she said she smoked marijuana.
she lied about breaking the law to sound cool. The Attorney General of California. That's pretty sad. That's pretty sad. As opposed to Jeb Bush in 2016, who several of his former classmates at Phillips Andover came forward and said that he was a drug dealer, and he viciously denied it despite the fact that he was a staunch opponent of decriminalizing marijuana. So it's very, very strange dynamic. I wonder. So if I remember correctly, Sarah Palin was not a huge celebrity figure in conservative circles before she was chosen as John McCain's vice president. She had her moment in the spotlight, but it seems that she's kind of disappeared since 2016. Trump has kind of usurped her and just gone about 100,000 miles beyond what she ever was in terms of the kind of the folksy populist personality. Joe Biden had been around forever when he was chosen as Barack Obama's vice president. And Paul Ryan was clearly a well-respected figure of the Republican establishment, and now he's sort of in he's become an elder statesman before his years, and he's enjoying his retirement. Now, what about Kamala Harris? What's she going to become? Is she going to become the next standard bearer of the Democratic Party, or is she going to be just a flash in the pan?
I suppose we'll see over the course of this election campaign. I mean, Joe Biden is not a young man. There's every likelihood that he would be a one-term president if he is elected, which means that she would be the front runner if she's vice president to become the nominee 4 years from now, if he's elected. Now, if he's not elected, then all bets are off. I mean, you have to look at the election campaign and say, was she a net benefit? In other words, did Biden lose despite her or because of her? Because if it looks as if Biden lost, but she polled well, then I think she's still the front runner for the presidential nomination 4 years from now. But making prognostications 4 years in advance is very dangerous. So who knows?
I saw a really good piece by James Antle at The Spectator talking about how Trump can basically attack Kamala Harris from the left and the right because her progressivism is extremely insincere, that's pretty obvious. But at the same time, her platform is way to the left of where even Joe Biden's, the majority of Biden supporters stand on the political spectrum. And so she's not a good progressive, and she's a very, very bad centrist. She makes kind of an odd standard bearer for the next generation of Democratic politicians. That and the fact that she, this has nothing to do with her being a woman or the color of her skin. She's just very uncharismatic. She's not a very appealing politician. Joe Biden has his kind of charisma. He's kind of an old school Irish Catholic brawler, but sort of has that elder statesman aura about him. Donald Trump has his pull no punches, New York loudmouth shtick. Kamala Harris doesn't really seem to have any of that. I really thought when I saw Cory Booker at the 2016 Democratic Convention, I thought that he would have made a really terrific, from a machine politics perspective, he would have made a terrific nominee. Kamala Harris is like the opposite of Cory Booker. She has no charisma whatsoever.
Well, she does have a resume. She's been attorney general of a very large state. She has been a senator. She polled reasonably well, although obviously she didn't mount a significant challenge to Biden, and nobody did, and that's amazing.
Mm.
Yeah. But the reason I think that she poses a difficulty for Biden and for the Democratic ticket generally is because, as you say, she postures to, she plays to the hard left,
yeah,
even though her resume doesn't look hard left. But we don't know what's going to unroll in the next few months. But right now, if you're playing to the hard left at a time when cities like Portland and Seattle are burning down because of the hard left, because of violence by the hard left, the voters are going to be asking themselves, do we really want someone who's not going to restore some sanity, restore some order to our society? And particularly if it's someone who has expressed hostility to, well, not to put too fine a point on it, to us, she's going to frighten people. I think the Democrats in this coming campaign season need to reassure the mainstream American, the undecided voters, that they are not in league with the crazies. And you can't do that by pandering to the hard left.
At the same time, there was this whole cottage industry that grew up out of the 2016 election. Curiously enough, former Bernie bros on both sides, some of whom said that Hillary Clinton was too far left, she was too elitist, and others who said that the Democratic Party ran too much to the right, they should have embraced their new quasi-socialistic base. I think that the Democratic establishment was clearly really pulling very hard for Biden. And there were all these pundits, even some at the New York Times, which is not a bastion of centrism, saying that, if it really comes down to Biden versus Sanders, we're going to get creamed if we nominate Sanders because he is so far to the left that, he's completely off the radar for most normal blue collar Americans. So what's curious, though, is that they got Biden. They got their arch-establishment candidate. He is so arch-establishment that, he couldn't have won an election. It wouldn't be possible for him to have won an election without the full-throated support of the Democratic establishment because he's totally incoherent. You have no idea what he thinks or what he says. So that was, they got everything they wanted on a silver platter, and yet they still had to line up this, another establishment tool, Kamala Harris, who is, very much a well-heeled product of the Democratic machine. They still had to sort of dress her up as an Antifa BLM radical. And this really should go to prove that even if Kamala Harris is insincere in her progressivism, the Democrats have no choice but to make room for the far-left Marxist socialistic elements in their own base. They can't avoid them anymore. They can't pretend they don't exist.
Well, and they particularly won't be able to pretend that this year because the hard left, will do what the hard left always does, which is put pressure on the Democrats from the left, from the far left. Yep. And some of that pressure will be violent. Some of it will be intimidating.
Yep.
And if Biden and Harris don't bow to Antifa, I think you'll see more violence in the cities, which will put more pressure on the Democrats. And yet, if they respond to that pressure, it's going to look like it's going to look very frightening for normal voters. So, and again, if you are a mainstream voter, if you're an undecided voter, and you see violence in the cities and you want someone who can restore order, and you're frightened that these episodes of violence are going to come affect your neighborhood, then you don't want someone who has a reputation for and a record for siding with these people and suggesting that they have common enemies. You don't want someone that, well, again, let's look at us as Catholics. We know that Antifa has a hostility to the church. We know that some of these demonstrations in cities have burst into violence and acts of violence and desecration against Catholic churches. And we know that Kamala Harris has a chip on her shoulder when it comes to Catholics. They start looking the same.
Mm. You know, we might actually finally find out once and for all who is behind the Democratic Party. Because the way I see it, there, and you made this point very astutely, the Democrats can respond to the Antifa BLM movement in one of two ways. They can either tilt towards law and order, or they can tilt towards accommodating the anarchy and the chaos. If they tilt towards the former, if they say there are legitimate grievances, yada yada, but we must protect lives and property, then you will that is how they win the election at the end of the day, because masked vandals and thugs roaming through Portland do not actually make up a huge amount of the voting population, so they're not going to make or break an election. If they stand up for law and order, then I think that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have a fairly good chance of winning the election. If, as I suspect what's going to happen, they lean into the left and they sort of embrace the anarchy and the chaos, they facilitate it, they accept it, they justify it, that will show that there is actually a cabal of radical ideologues that is controlling the Democratic Party. They will throw away the election, but they will also shift the Overton window to the left. That is the situation in which I see Donald Trump winning, because his poll numbers are down, not looking great. But if he can frame the Democratic Party as the party that will put you under house arrest for coronavirus and only let you leave so you can beat up your neighbor or rob his store, smash his windows and grab everything you can and run, then Biden and Harris have absolutely no chance. No chance at all.
Yes, well, I think that Trump would be missing an opportunity so obvious that if he doesn't take that line, he doesn't deserve to win, because the opportunity is so obvious. I just make one amendment to what you said. I think I agree, except this, that if the Democratic ticket leans towards law and order, I think the result will be that Antifa and its allies will be even more militant, causing even more violence, and therefore ramping up the demands among the populace, among the voters, for law and order. And if it's a campaign dominated by the law and order issue, Trump wins.
Yeah, that could be true. That could be true. Maybe that's why that they haven't done it. Maybe they're just going to ignore the whole thing. That's been the Democrat strategy throughout most of this campaign, has just been to ignore the difficult questions and keep hammering home that, Trump's low poll numbers and coronavirus, which is something that they kind of sort of have a grip on. They at least have a coherent policy, as opposed to virtually every other issue that voters actually care about. You know, Joe Biden tweeted something the other day that was something like, when I'm president, you won't have to worry about my Twitter. And that's kind of the line that he's running on. And look, I'm not a huge fan. I hate Twitter. And I'm not a particular fan of President Trump's Twitter. But if the idea is that he's just going to play into Trump fatigue and say, you know, this shtick is getting old, let's do something else, let's go back to normal, that seems to be the only thing that he actually has to run on. That's the only really appealing thing about Joe Biden at this point, is that he's not Donald Trump. How appealing that is going to actually be to the voting public is quite another kettle of fish.
Well, we'll find out in a few weeks. And then thank God it will be over.
Yes, that's more or less my attitude. Well, we have to wrap up pretty soon, but I just wanted to mention one last bit of news. Give sort of a public service announcement to our listeners. I'm sure many of you have heard about Father Jeremy Leatherby, a priest in Sacramento who has been in the news for a couple of years for various issues in his private life. We don't have to go into that now. But Father Leatherby, very sad case, was recently formally excommunicated by his bishop because he publicly, repeatedly denied that Pope Francis is the true successor of St. Peter and that Pope Benedict is still Pope. And again, just a quick PSA, guys, I see a lot of this on the internet, on social media, and, you know, it's kind of bandied around. Don't do it. Don't do it. This is not only an intellectual dead end. It's not only a totally ridiculous proposition. It's also, as this incident should demonstrate, spiritually very dangerous. Joking, you know, we can all, whatever fault we might find with Pope Francis, and Phil and I have both been very critical of him in the past, and I think rightly so, and will continue to be so as necessary. He is the true successor to St. Peter. He is the legitimate Pope. We owe him our loyalty and, to the extent that we can, our love. Benedict is not the Pope anymore. He stepped down. He is the Bishop Emeritus of Rome, the Pope Emeritus, whatever you want to call him. He is not he is not at the helm of the bark of Peter any longer. And this is, I know that this is a fantasy that some conservatives and traditionalists like to play over in their heads. Wouldn't it be amazing if it doesn't matter? It doesn't matter. This, to publicly and repeatedly declare that Pope Benedict is still Pope can, as this incident should show, incur automatic excommunication. And to die in a state of excommunication, period, is going to put your soul, your immortal soul, in serious jeopardy. And I'm just going to read a quote that from Father Leatherby himself in his public letter, where he said, I quote, "I deservedly incur automatic excommunication if Bergoglio is indeed the valid successor of St. Peter, and I am guilty of causing great division within the mystical body of Christ," end quote. Now, of course, Father Leatherby goes on to say, you know, in good conscience, I must profess what I believe to be true. That's between him and God. Again, not going to judge the state of his soul. But if you're going to make these claims, these absurd and illegitimate claims, don't treat it like an intellectual game. Think seriously about the consequences that it will have for your soul. Anything to add to that, Phil?
No, I think Father Leatherby, to his credit, has recognized the seriousness of what he's doing. And there are two different issues here. One is the issue of the charges against him. We're not commenting on those. That is, the charges of misconduct. They're several years old. That's still an ongoing process. Whether he was treated fairly or not, I suspect not. That's not relevant to what we're saying here. The question here is whether a priest is obligated to recognize the authority of the current successor to St. Peter, and the answer to that question is yes.
Yes. As he himself admits.
Yes.
He does not deny that. So, yeah, again, this conspiracy, we even get submissions from writers, you know, wanting to make the argument that Pope Benedict is still the true Pope. As if this is just some curious idea that we can bandy about. It's like a shuttlecock. a little game that philosophers play. It's not. And we would not be good journalists or good Catholics, good brothers and sisters in Christ, if we didn't warn you about that, if we didn't just put out that word of caution. So that's all I have to say on the matter. How about you, Phil?
You sum it nicely.
Thank you. Well, then, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week. But as always, I'm very grateful to you all for joining us, as I know Phil is. And we really look forward to speaking with you again next week. So until then, I am Michael Warren Davis. He is Philip F. Lawler. And this is The Crisis Point. Thank you all very much, and God bless you.